Россия применит ядерное оружие, если она будет стоять США перед
в радиоактивный пепел.
Ядерные заряды должны лететь в сторону стран,
применять ядерное оружие
в скандинавской стране ядерным ударом.
Запуск межконтинентальной баллистической ракеты.
Перед постановкой на дежурство новых ракетных комплексов.
Применить ядерное оружие.
И мы на это готовы.
Владимир Путин, it appears, has decided to flex his missiles. Last month, Russia's ambassador in Copenhagen threatened to target Denmark's warships with nuclear weapons if that country joins NATO's defense shield. Russian generals also reportedly told U.S. officials during a meeting in Germany in March that Moscow would utilize, quote, a spectrum of responses from nuclear to non-military if NATO moved more forces into the Baltic states. And in a recent documentary film aired on Russian state television, Putin himself said he was prepared to put the country's nuclear forces on alert during the annexation of Crimea a year ago. Is it all bluster, the geopolitical equivalent of Putin's fondness for being photographed shirtless, or does it point to something darker? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow, where he is temporarily embedded, is co-host Mark Gagliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Здравствуйте, Брайан.
Здравствуйте. I hope you're enjoying Mark. Enjoying Moscow, Mark. It's just you and I today, so let's get to it. All this nuclear posturing is taking place in the context of a lot of silliness, let's say. We've had a lot of weird statements coming out of the Kremlin. We had the Speaker of the Chechen Parliament threatening to arm Mexico if the United States arms Ukraine. We, leaving aside the fact that the United States and Mexico have excellent relations, we've had a State Duma deputy calling for criminal charges against former State Department spokeswoman Jen Psaki and British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond for extremism. Mark, is all this nuclear bluster just another example of this, of what I've called silly season, or is there something more frightening going on here?
Well, let me just pull back to those two examples you gave about Texas and Mexico on the one hand, and then these sort of international investigations of people on the other, because I think they all fit within a spectrum. These are all headline-grabbing initiatives that frankly mean very, very little, but they hearten the, sort of the Kremlin's own constituents. They alarm those people who can be alarmed, shall we say, and they open up gaps between those who can be alarmed and those who are more sanguine. So the idea is that they're meant to basically spread dismay and uncertainty. And so also I think that the whole nuclear issue fits into this. It is essentially worth remembering that nukes, for all their devastating capacity, are essentially political rather than military instruments. And in most cases, they have, thank God, been proven entirely unusable. They didn't, for example, stop Argentina from invading the Falklands because it knew full well that the Brits weren't going to nuke Buenos Aires as a response. In that case, really, we're talking about symbols of national concern. But on the one hand, as soon as you mention nuclear weapons, you know you're going to get column inches. This attracts attention in the West, the very fact that we're talking about it. Secondly, it's actually surprisingly cheap and easy, firstly, obviously, to claim certain things, but even actually to move nuclear missiles, because you have mobile ones. You don't have to spend a lot of money necessarily developing bases and that kind of thing, in a way that if you said we're going to garrison another brigade of troops somewhere. But essentially, when it comes down to it, it's a political instrument, hoping that they'll dismay enough people that it'll bring some leverage to bear on the West.
So the goal of this political instrument is for domestic consumption or for international consumption?
It's primarily for international consumption. It has a minor domestic value in that exactly there is a certain constituency that it heartens, but this is a constituency that anyway is feeling quite comfortable with what's going on in the Kremlin at the moment.
But nevertheless,
don't we find this a little bit disturbing? I know, I mean, we didn't even hear this kind of rhetoric during the Cold War. The Soviet Union didn't use this kind of nuclear bluster openly in public. And if you recall, when Ronald Reagan, when there was a live mic, made his famous comment in the early 80s that what it was that I've decided to sign legislation outlawing the Soviet Union, we begin bombing in 5 minutes. He was pilloried for that. Mm-hmm. He was pilloried for that. When in fact, let's face it, nobody really believed that Ronald Reagan was about to nuke the Soviet Union at that time. But the fact of using that kind of rhetoric itself was viewed as irresponsible and dangerous. So are we crossing some kind of a threshold here that we didn't even cross during the Cold War?
It is a threshold, but I think we have to be very, very aware what kind of threshold it is. Let me be uncharacteristically upbeat, in the sense that there is not going to be any possibility of the use of nuclear weapons, and frankly, I don't believe for a moment the Kremlin has any thought of using nuclear weapons. What is different, though, is absolutely that, first of all, you have a Kremlin that is willing to break the rules in a way that actually the old Soviet Kremlin never did.
Yeah.
The old Cold War, that was characterized by what we could call an etiquette. You sublimate your conflicts into Olympics and ice hockey and proxy wars in the developing world and everything else. But you do everything you can to actually avoid the risk of direct confrontation. You have a common interest in the rules of the game. Yes, you would push your own interests, but within the context of a relatively stable international order. Putin's Kremlin is not that. Putin's Kremlin is avowedly revisionist. It wants to basically break the international system because actually it feels that a more anarchic context would actually give it more options. So that's first crucial difference. And the second then is actually that it also speaks to a certain desperation. Where do you go after you've played the nuclear card? What else do you honestly have left in your hand? It's interesting because this happened at the same time we have five Nordic nations that were actually coming together to formally and specify that actually Russia was the main threat that they saw and so forth. I think this is a point in which actually the Kremlin sees the tide rolling against it. And instead of thinking, well, no, let's go with the tide. I think, we have overreached. We need to rebuild bridges and so forth. Instead, it is trying to think, well, okay, how can we break this wave up? Mm-hmm. How can we actually introduce rocks on which it'll break? So this is still a Kremlin that is aggressively leaning forward in its foreign policy aspirations rather than actually thinking that maybe it's time to pull back.
You touch on something important here, and that is that the Soviet Union was essentially a satisfied power that was satisfied with the international arrangements as they were. Russia is not. Russia is for to use Kissingerian terms, a revolutionary power. Mm-hmm. And although Kissinger himself would probably disagree with using that particular characterization to describe Putin's Russia, but I will use it anyway. And that's certainly one reason why Russia is willing to break out of the so-called Cold War etiquette. Are there other reasons as well? I mean, this is a younger generation. This generation of Russian leaders, why were they not influenced by that Cold War etiquette? They were alive during the Cold War, were they not? I mean, they certainly remember that they weren't in positions of power. But are there other reasons, maybe generational, that account for this lack of willingness to obey what is up to now being considered informal etiquette?
It may well be a generational factor, and I think it's particularly because although this current generation, some of them were small kids and some of them had to deal with the outcomes, but actually this is not a generation that went through the Great Patriotic War. This is not a generation that really saw what mass carnage is all about. This is a generation who war is something that soldiers, who are obviously not you guys, I mean, none of them are soldiers, it's worth mentioning. War is something that other people do in relatively controlled environments. Mm-hmm. And when they come home in boxes, that's a political inconvenience rather than a massive demographic tragedy. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think that is one factor. But the second factor is also one that just as the West was pretty sure that the Soviets, especially in sort of the later Soviet years, would not even contemplate a nuclear attack as anything more than just a last-ditch response to a true existential threat. Well, so too, you know, in their heart of hearts, the Kremlin realized that actually NATO was not going about to sort of spill eastwards and try. So, I mean, there's always moments, I mean, particularly with the so-called Able Archer exercise incident, where massive NATO exercises were taken by the Russians for a while as being potentially actually the start of a genuine invasion. But generally speaking, people had faith in the fact that the other side wasn't out to destroy them. But also they had faith that if necessary, the other side would. Now, I think the trouble is, trouble for us, as it were, the West, is that this current generation of Russian politicians, not only are they a little bit more cavalier about military threats, but also they don't really fear the West. Mm-hmm. They know that basically, I mean, what is the West going to do? They can huff and they can puff. I mean, the sanctions have taken, certainly have taken Russia by surprise, or the Russian leadership by surprise, the fact that it's been sustained for so long. But even so, this is not a devastating impact. I mean, you know, the streets of Moscow, one can see certain impacts of sanctions, but on the, you know, even since the time I've been here, the ruble has strengthened. Mm-hmm. Oil prices are not continuing to sort of plummet down.
No, they're staying stable, yeah.
You know, basically, you know, yeah, life is getting harder for a lot of Russians who are feeling squeezed, but there's nothing dramatic. And therefore, I mean, I think there probably is a sense, at least amongst some people in the Kremlin, is this the best you've got? I think that would be very wrong-headed and really quite dangerous. But I suspect that particularly if you're living inside the Kremlin bubble, and you know, let's face it, the people who are in charge all do live inside the Kremlin bubble and do not venture out of it, then I think there is that sense of really we don't need to fear the West.
Right. Now, there's another thing you mentioned. They didn't live through the Great Patriotic War. There's another thing in more recent history they didn't. They were children during, and that's the Cuban Missile Crisis, which, as we all know, had a huge effect on the generation that lived through that as adults, and the great fear of escalation, which led to a great fear of even using rhetoric that could lead to escalation, coming that close to the brink as the world did in October 1962. There's another thing I also wanted to touch on here, and I think that this is what I think is the case. Is Russia's fixation on nuclear weapons, or the current regime's current fixation on nuclear weapons, is really a sign of weakness. If you think back to the when they were negotiating a new start during the reset, which seems like a mythological science fiction movie or another age at this point. But if you remember, the Americans really wanted to go down to parity at a much, much, much lower level than they ultimately did, because let's face it, the Americans don't really rely on their nuclear deterrent. That's not the main. That's not the main tool in their military arsenal. America relies on its conventional superiority, and Russia is very aware of this. And at the time, there were articles in the Russian press arguing that, you know, the Americans are trying to take this too far down, and that's really going to hurt us. We have to keep the nuclear threshold a little bit higher, because basically that's all they got. And if you really take, so now this flexing, this reminding the world that we have nukes, you said, is that all you got in terms of the sanctions? Well, this is basically all they got in terms of military, no?
Well, I mean, just ask the Ukrainians. It depends on what kind.
In terms of whom you're threatening.
Yeah, but I mean, there's certainly no question that they can threaten NATO. I mean, frankly, not even on, you know, on a conventional or nuclear level. But I don't honestly think that that's actually the calculation. I mean, I think the calculations are as much political. But I would agree that this what you call a fixation is indeed a sign of weakness. And in some ways, let me just draw the parallel of Russia's military doctrine says that nuclear weapons should only be used in response to a nuclear attack or threat, or in response to a conventional but existential threat to Russia.
And which distinct from Soviet military doctrine, and you're the expert on this, so correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm sure you will, but the Soviets pledged no first use.
Absolutely.
Full stop.
But what's changed is China has changed. And if you look at them, every year they update their battle plan for how they would cope with the war with China. And to be perfectly honest, I don't think they should spend more than 5 minutes on that. Because the only real question is how quickly you go nuclear. Because the Chinese can very quickly break both the Trans-Siberian and the Baikal Amur Magistral. And at that point, resupply becomes impossible for the Russians, and essentially Siberia is gone. And so
Russia has no chance in a conventional war with China, is what you're saying?
No, not really. I mean, it can deliver a lot of damage, but if China is committed, then China wins. But the point is exactly, the Russians know this, and so the real question is at what point and how quickly, which the answer is very quickly, they would have to go nuclear. And that is in some ways a metaphor for, I think, the whole issue. Actually, Russia has often surprisingly few intermediary options. It's basically all out or nothing that really makes a difference. And likewise with its rhetoric. I mean, it continues to send bombers into the air and so forth. But that had a certain shock value for a while, but now it's just become routine and expensive irritation.
Right.
And the only way they got the bombers back into the news is by, well, the news that, in fact, those bombers might actually have nuclear weapons.
They were nuclear capable, yeah. Yeah.
But actually, you know, some suggestions that they might actually have had been mounting nuclear bombs. So in this respect, you know, the Russians are caught in an escalating rhetorical battle.
Mm-hmm.
And the trouble is, you know, once you go nuclear, as I say, where do you go beyond that?
Right.
The answer is there isn't really
any. There isn't any place to go. One of the things that that this caused me to recall was another thing from recent American history, relatively recent American history. I don't know if you remember the Richard Nixon's madman theory of war. This came out in H.R. Haldeman's book, The Ends of Power, which was his memoir of the Nixon administration. And he's talking about how Nixon was trying to convince the North Vietnamese that he was crazy in order to get them to come to the negotiating table. I'm going to quote from the book because I think this really sums it up, because I think this might be germane to what we're dealing with here with Putin. Here's Haldeman quoting Nixon. I call it the madman theory, Bob. I want the North Vietnamese to believe I've reached the point where I might do anything to stop the war. We'll just slip the word to them that, for God's sakes, you know, Nixon is obsessed. We can't restrain him in any way when he's angry, and he has his hand on the nuclear button. If we do this, then Ho Chi Minh himself will be in Paris in 2 days begging for peace. That's H.R. Haldeman quoting Richard Nixon. Do you think there's a little, this might be a little bit about what Putin's trying to do, kind of convincing the world that he's kind of lost the plot and he has his hands on the nuclear button and we better just back off and let him do what he wants? Do you think there's a little bit of that at play here?
It's hard to be sure. My honest suspicion is the answer is no, for two reasons. One is that, in fact, I mean, if nothing else, one can think just how deeply peeved the Russians were when Angela Merkel made her comment about essentially Putin being on another planet. They don't like the idea that essentially they're being characterized as these sort of, you know, frothing lunatics. Secondly, though, you see, this is a very high-risk strategy. If they do this, then yes, it might lead to the West backing off. But on the other hand, it might mean that they actually decide, look, clearly there is no way we can operate with this Kremlin, and therefore pushes the West towards what is to originate, which, let's face it, some in the West already are advocating quietly. So it's possible, but I think that if so, it's not something that they've telegraphed yet. And it will be something new, and I think it will be very, very high risk. It just doesn't click for me, I must say.
So I guess to go back to the question I posed at the very beginning of the segment, we're dealing with the functional equivalent here of the geopolitical equivalent of Putin posing with his shirt off, then.
It's not just simply about bare-chested posing, because this is, after all, actually, it's an open threat. I think it's rather more, it is an attempt to basically intimidate. I mean, this is the equivalent of sort of Putin going nose to nose and hoping that the West will back down. Not because I think he's going to try and suggest that we're lunatics, but rather because I think he's trying to suggest that we have more will. And I think that is the key thing. To Putin, I'm increasingly coming to believe that he thinks that the crucial issue is about will. That's the national resource that Russia has got at its disposal. And so in some ways, I think he's trying to telegraph that, because he thinks that's precisely where the West is weakest.
That's their asymmetrical advantage, if you will. I want to wrap up this section with some comments that Stanislav Belkovsky, the political analyst, made on Echo Moscow, where he was saying that in relation to Putin's nuclear blustering, he says the line between political games and reality can be very thin. And that's why this could get very, very dangerous. Last thoughts on that?
Again, I don't think we have any risk of things going nuclear, but when we come down to it, actually wars tend to start because rational people make what seem to be rational decisions based on inaccurate or misunderstood data. And that, for me, is the real problem, that actually Putin's bluster, firstly, it actually reflects a lack of understanding of the West, but secondly, it leads the West to make misunderstandings about Russia. This is for me, definitely alarming, but as I said, it's not nuclear alarming.
What would you say the effect is in the West of all of this? How do you see Western capitals? I mean, the Danish had to get very nervous when he made that comment, when that comment was made by the ambassador about targeting the warships. I know the Baltic states are getting very nervous because they feel they're being that kind of the subjects of nuclear blackmail. Remember that these generals reportedly told U.S. officials they would use everything up to including nuclear to prevent more NATO troops from going into the Baltics. How is this being received? What effect is this? Do you see this having in Western capitals?
Well, I mean, obviously, sort of the Baltic experience is one extreme. Recently, I was in Prague, and actually, the Czech government is much more relaxed. Even though, you know, the nature of NATO is such that actually the Czech border is at number two when it comes down to it. But I think again, what it does is it signals to Western capitals that in fact that the Putin regime is precisely one that is actually challenging not just specific policies, but the whole foundations of the order, which the West regards as essential. And what I can't help but feel is that all these things do is, in the short term, they create alarm. In the long term, though, they actually provide more ammunition for those people who are saying we actually need to do something dramatic about the Kremlin regime. In other words, the regime change faction. Mm-hmm.
Or basically doing what a lot of people are advocating in essentially metaphorically building the wall. I mean, Russia's been integrated with the West for all these decades now. And there's people who are making the argument that you should cut them off from SWIFT, kick the Russian money out of the city of London, and so on and so forth. Basically a divorce, if you will. Could this give people who are arguing for those kinds of things more ammunition as well?
Yeah, well, good luck with getting Russian money out of the city of London. And indeed, you know, good luck with generally an attempt at that kind of containment. The fact is that the modern world does not lend itself to that kind of isolation. This is not a country that wants to become a North Korea, and this is not a country we want to make a North Korea. Actually, you know, let's face it, if we went to those kind of extremes, apart from that, it would have dramatic impacts, especially on Europe, impacts that Europe is not willing to accept. But also, it would have devastating impacts on Russia. I mean, that actually is, you might say, the West's nuclear option. Mm-hmm. And in those circumstances, I don't think for a minute that Putin would actually seriously think, well, okay, then let's nuke Milwaukee. But on the other hand, certainly he would have far fewer compunctions, because at that point, what has he got to lose? Mm-hmm. Why shouldn't he actually send tanks into Estonia? Mm-hmm. Why shouldn't he do anything that he wants? Because basically the West is trying to destroy him. And frankly, if we went to that point, this is not about containment as a sort of a neutral and sterile process. This would actually be something which would be implicitly, if not directly, aimed at bringing down the Russian economy. Mm-hmm. And if we do that, then we are declaring war without any question.
Right. Okay, well, on that note, we'll shift gears. In a few moments, we'll shift gears and take a look at the issue of corruption in Russia, which came into focus this week when the Justice Ministry branded the watchdog group Transparency International a foreign agent. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow, where he is temporarily embedded, is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian organized crime and security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can also watch the newly launched Daily Vertical at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Yeah.
I'm an ardent patriot of my country.
I have no other choice but to try and change the situation here. If we accept the formula that political activity pursues changes in state policy, then it means that the fight against corruption attempts to change state policy. So it appears that state policy is, in effect, corruption.
Well, that was Yelena Panfilova, the head of Transparency International's Moscow branch, speaking this week after the Justice Ministry labeled the venerable anti-corruption watchdog a foreign agent. According to Russian legislation, of course, groups that receive foreign funds and are attempting to change or influence state policy must be registered as such. But as Panfilova notes, Transparency is not trying to change state policy, at least formal state policy. They're just trying to enforce it. Then, as she said, there's a paradox here. If countering corruption is an attempt to change state policy, then state policy must therefore be corruption. Pretty flawless logic, Mark. No, I mean, and she's kind of onto something here, I think. I mean, state policy in some ways is corruption, is it not?
Well, I mean, I've got a lot of sympathy for Panfilova. And obviously, yes, corruption is one of the ways in which actually this regime controls and empowers.
It's not a bug in the system. It's a feature.
But at the same time, I mean, you know, in absolute fairness, one has to note, of course, Transparency International does seek to influence state policy, not just in terms of enforcing, but actually it says this is how the laws ought to be and so forth. I mean, you know, it is a lobby group. It is a lobby group, I think, that is, you know, an admirable one. But nonetheless, technically speaking, it does meet those criteria for this.
Right, but what it's trying to do is to stop corruption. And if that's so, if that is influencing state policy to stop corruption.
No, but it's influencing state policy in the sense of, you know, it tries to have an input into the laws. It tries to have an input into a whole variety of different sort of regulations and so forth. It is lobby. See what you've done, Brian. You've made me a Kremlin apologist.
I just did it. David Johnson, take note.
But I mean, it is absolutely the case that Transparency International does seek to actually influence, not just encourage the state to apply its own laws, but influence how those laws and regulations are written. Mm-hmm. So in that respect, look, it okay. does fit the criteria. But let that not obscure the fundamental point is precisely that, in fact, you know, that obviously corruption is absolutely integral to the Putin system. And therefore, clearly, an organization like Transparency International is antithetical to that system.
Yeah. Now, we were chatting off mic during the week, and you noted a couple of interesting things. Mikhail Zadornov basically said that corruption today is worse than it is in the 90s, which you indicated that you believed is utter nonsense. I'm not so sure. It depends how you make your definitions. And also, we had Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov making some what seemed to be very defensive statements about the fact that the Kremlin is still, in fact, trying to fight corruption. Let's take each of those in turn. You believe it's complete nonsense that corruption today is not worse than the 90s? And what are we talking
about?
Pretty
much on every scale. I mean, first of all, predatory street corruption.
Okay.
Is absolutely.
That I'll grant you.
Interestingly and depressingly enough, just from our conversations here in Moscow, it sounds as if it's beginning to perk back up. Mm-hmm. And in part, it's things like Moscow police now are being paid, not being paid bonuses on the same level and that kind of thing. You know, there's a lot of people who are being squeezed, and this is one of the classic ways that you make up the shortfall in your earnings if you happen to be a gatekeeper or an enforcer. But even on the massive level, yes, of course, there's huge levels of corruption in sweetheart deals. But when we set that against the loans for shares, when we set that up against the privatization campaigns and what happened with the voucher auctions and so mm-hmm. forth, that was indeed the plundering of a whole country. Now we have a plundering of a state budget, which is, you know, obviously an egregious challenge. but nonetheless is, I think, on a totally different order of magnitude.
Isn't that just a function of the difference in the two times, though? I mean, when we're talking about the 90s, we're talking about the privatization period. We're talking about when everything was up for grabs. Now, basically, and this kind of parallels our discussion last week about the about the changing nature of organized crime over this period. Then you had a free-for-all. Then corruption was balkanized. Now the five families, so to speak, have been united. There's one godfather in town, and corruption is centralized. But I'm not sure it's any less now than it was then.
Well,
I'm not sure about that. At the mass scale, at the street level, I'll grant you that's for sure.
No, I mean, there comes a certain point where actually trying to sort of assess the difference in the levels of corruption becomes more about theology than mathematics, because it is about, is it more corrupt to have an entire industry privatized into a handful of people's back pockets than to have a huge chunk of the state budget spent on sweetheart deals for various people? But when it comes down to it, I mean, it's a very sort of basic rule of thumb, but under the current system, on the whole, stuff gets done. It just gets done much more expensively than it ought to be. Whereas in the 1990s, a lot of stuff just didn't get done. Mm. It was just purely theft. I mean, maybe actually we're talking about a difference between theft and corruption. Mm-hmm. But either way, I mean, I honestly think that the parallels with the 1990s are distinctly muddle-headed and really don't work without in any way kind of minimizing what's going on now. It is just exactly, as you say, a much more orderly structure.
It's a much more orderly structure in which corruption isn't, like I said before, it's not a bug in the system. It's a feature. And I would say in the 90s, it was like the grease on the wheels. Now it's the gasoline in the engine. I mean, I think the system now runs on corruption, basically.
The system then ran on corruption.
Yeah, but it wasn't centralized. It was this diffuse kind of
but the real big corruption was basically, after all, was the processes that created the oligarchs. Mm. Those oligarchs who basically bought Yeltsin his re-election. That is absolutely as central and as systemic as you can get. So again, I mean, without defending the current model, it was a much crasser and cruder system in the 1990s, as befits the 1990s and as befits the fact that it was a part of a state building process rather than a sort of state maintaining process. But it was deeply, deeply corrupt.
Now, what did you make of Dmitry Peskov's comments this week that they did appear very, very defensive? It was almost like, yes, the state fighting corruption is state policy. No, really, 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 it is. I mean, that's the only way I can. I'm not going to read them out, but that's basically the gist. What did you make of that?
I mean, it was faintly pathetic, actually. And I think it does reflect the fact that you have this thorough disconnect between rhetoric and reality. Rhetorically, you've got Sergei Ivanov, who recently called corruption a direct threat to the security and national sovereignty of Russia, which is, in the sort of the lexicon of Russian political discourse. As soon as you start talking about it as a security threat, you mean this is a really big thing. And then when one looks at what's actually happened, you just had recently the decision to allow officials of state-owned companies that they can actually keep their income secret.
Right.
When you have people like...
And they lobbied heavily for that.
Yeah, well, you had Yakunin of Russian Railways saying that he'd resign rather than tell people how much money he had. I suppose it's someone who's got a $31,000 watch maybe has more of an interest in actually keeping this secret. But, the state backed down. And really obviously backed down. And even the sort of the data we've had recently, when they were trying to boast about success, doesn't say success. I mean, again, the figures for the first half of last year, 120,000 case investigations opened into corruption, which sounds big. 5,000 people were held accountable, 5,000 officials held accountable. Well, okay, excellent. However, when you look at it, actually only 4% of them, 200 of them, were actually sacked. So basically you had fines and reprimands. So at worst, people who stole money were forced to hand some money back. That does not really count as any particular sort of great success. So, I mean, I think the bind that the Kremlin finds now is, first of all, that it has to talk about corruption. It has to pretend, at least. And secondly, I think there's a lot of people within the system who realize that corruption is a serious problem now that the economy is in crisis, that they can't afford a featherbed, the the officials, the oligarchs and such like in the way they did before. But when it comes down to it, because, as you say, it's an integral part of the system rather than just some little aberration, no one knows how to do anything about it other than, you know, the kind of systemic campaign which really would mean fighting a war with the elite.
Right, which would mean undermining the very foundation of the elite. What does this tell you about where this regime is right now? I mean, it seems like it's at its wit's end almost, because it has to do something about this because the pie is shrinking.
Yeah, I think that basically its creative capacities have gone. It's in a situation in which basically it will, when it sees overt threats, it will resist them. Yes. When you have immediate crises, it will parachute someone in and try and find some money, get some oligarch to pledge some money to deal with it on a case-by-case basis. Essentially, this is now a firefighting regime. Mm-hmm. It does not know what to do to actually address any of the systemic problems. And these are systemic problems that are relating to not just the economy or even the political system, but even actually if you go back to foreign policy and so forth. I mean, you know, it is stuck in so many ways, whether it's stuck in the Donbass or stuck not being able to deal with the corruption that it is aware is eating the system from the inside, but it just does not know what to do. It feels it has no options.
Well, I'll throw another paradox out there, too. The corruption is eating the system from the inside, but it is also one of the key instruments of Russian foreign policy. Let's face it. One of the ways that Russia pursues its foreign policy goals is something called, that Chatham House called, elite capture, right? Mm-hmm. Using corruption to capture elites abroad. That's corruption, too. And so it's very ironic. The thing that's giving Russia influence abroad is also eating it alive from the inside.
Yeah, I mean, look, we also have to be clear that Russia is not the only country that practices elite capture.
They're very good at it, though.
They are very good at it, but in some ways they have to be because they have no real soft power, or rather they have no positive soft power. But yeah, I mean, I think there is this point that just as the sort of, you know, the great Alexander Nevsky, you know, those who come with us from the sword will die by the sword. Well, so too, I mean, in some ways, those who have been exploiting and using corruption are also now dying from corruption.
And to bring it back to from where we started, I mean, on the branding of Transparency International as a foreign agent this week, the Moscow Times had an interesting piece on this where they quoted analysts as saying this shows that the Kremlin finds foreign influence more dangerous than corruption. Which I thought that was an interesting way to frame the story, and I think it's very, very telling. You have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, but I think the thing is we also have to realize the extent to which, from the Kremlin's perspective, these two elements merge. Corruption is, I still think, I've said it in the past, I'm going to bore you by saying it again, I think the potential Achilles heel of this regime. It's the one issue that really could unite middle-ranking elite, middle class, and above all, ordinary people in opposition to the Kremlin. And I think there is a particular fear that this actually, therefore, would become one of these issues on which, if the West really did want to try and actually seriously make a pitch to bring down this regime, that would be one of the potential instruments at their disposal. So I think, again, this is in part, this is just the workings of the machine. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that actually the Kremlin decided this on Transparency International. It could just simply be some person, some bureaucrat who felt that it would work. But it does reflect the extent to which I think that the Kremlin really is concerned about the extent to which, just as it uses elite capture, the West could use, shall we say, elite detachment or mass capture and turn the corruption issue against the Kremlin. Mm-hmm.
Well, on that note, I guess we can wrap it up. That, unfortunately, is all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow, where he's temporarily embedded, has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russia's organized crime and security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Thanks, Mark, for the enlightening discussion.
My pleasure.
And I'd also like to thank our producer, Jan Kaiser, who's ably filling in for the ridiculously overworked Tanya Koncheva as she takes a much-deserved vacation from me.
I'd also like to thank my totally awesome and indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the newly launched Daily Vertical at rfurl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.